The second scripture reading is Mark 11, 15 to 17. Then they came to Jerusalem, and he entered the temple and began to drive out those who were selling and those who were buying in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. And he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. He was teaching and saying, "Is it not written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations'? But you have made it a den of robbers."
I want to start with a reading from The Emerging Christian Way. It's a book of essays. Marcus Borg, Matthew Fox, lots of folks you've heard of, some folks you haven't heard of. And I want to read a portion of an essay called Social Justice and a Spirituality of Transformation by Bill Phipps. What could I possibly say? I was blank. Sitting at my desk, I stared first at the piles of papers on the floor, on the chair, on the table. I stared at the piles of mail waiting my attention. I stared at the stack of newspapers collected in my weeks away. It was the night before Easter Sunday. The church would be full. My body was jet-lagged. My mind was blank. Our congregation is in middle-class, secure Calgary, Alberta. I had returned home from Sudan on Wednesday after hearing horrendous stories of the slaughter of innocent people. As part of a delegation of church leaders, we were investigating the stories about villages near the oil fields being razed and civilians of all ages being massacred. Talisman Energy, headquartered in Calgary, was denying such realities. The stories were true. In one case, we sat in a circle in the bush hearing the detailed account of the fate of one such village. Taking the lead from the paramount chief, the other chiefs told of helicopter gunships swooping down on their village, firebombing their homes, and shooting the villagers as they fled. One of us in the circle asked, "How many were killed?" The paramount chief said, "We don't think in numbers." Instead, the people named the grandmothers, children, parents. They represented each with a stone or a stick, which they placed in the middle of the circle. We watched, stunned. With tears in our eyes, we watched this dignified process, these dignified faces. Margaret Atwood is correct. The facts of this world seen clearly are seen through tears. Why tell me that there is something wrong with my eyes? How could I preach to a congregation of secure, oil-friendly people after witnessing such pain inflicted to extract oil in a faraway place? But the refugee storytellers had not finished telling their story by naming the dead. After further conversation, the surviving villagers straightened their backs and began to sing. A glorious sound filled the air. Again, we were stunned to silence. Again, we wept. These southern Sudanese people would not be defeated or intimidated. Their songs rang not only with defiance, but with genuine hope. I had my sermon after all. On Easter Sunday, 2001, I told that story of courage and beauty in the midst of fear, uncertainty, and horror. It is, after all, what Easter is really about. Some of you may remember when we went through this book together in Al Contreras's Ponder This class way back in the day. This book was published in 2006, so to name names, this was during the George W. Bush era. Does anybody remember that era? Okay. And in those days, I was reading a lot of books about international peace and social justice and economic justice and ecological justice and justice for the incarcerated and the homeless and the immigrants and those victimized by corporations and governments around the world. But although I just listed all of those topics that I had been reading in sort of a positive sense, what I really got from the reading was talking points about what was wrong with the world and how it would all be better if we would just have a regime change in the United States, right? And I think a lot of us were thinking a lot about regime change in 2006, both as something that was possible and something that would at least start to address a lot of these issues. So we got our regime change, right? And a lot of us slowed down our reading and our activism on these topics. Anti-war protests quit happening in downtown Portland and in other cities around the country, even though the war continued. And the only exception to that I know of is the really nice guy who used to have the peace vigils on Hall Boulevard in front of the Beaverton Library. Remember that guy? I don't know how many of you met him. I went to his vigil a few times. But he kept his going for, I don't know, maybe 6 months or a year into the Obama years. But for the most part, we just kind of quit protesting and quit using activism and even quit being informed about a lot of this stuff. And what happened? We probably slowed down our waging of war compared to what might have happened under some other government. But we still haven't had a single minute when there weren't American troops in combat since 9/11. And when I say combat, I mean shooting warfare, even if it's not classified as combat, right? And while our military has found great ways to minimize casualties on our side, the local communities where the wars are fought are not so lucky. And if you add up all the combat deaths of local citizens where we've had our adventures in warfare since 9/11, I think we're undisputably into the six figures now. A lot of the activism for economic justice went on hiatus in 2009 as well, right? It would be 3 years before the Occupy movement would spring up to raise these issues all over again. And again, what we got was some baby steps and tweaking around the edges in the direction of economic justice and ecological justice and justice for the incarcerated and immigrants specifically. But more than 90% of the economic gains of the Obama era went to the top 0.1%. And homelessness became an epidemic problem at a level not seen since the Great Society. I really think some similar things were happening in the 8th century BCE in Palestine. It was a time of economic growth for both the northern kingdom of Israel and the southern kingdom of Judah. A period of exile ended in the north when their captors were defeated by another power, so all of a sudden they were free and able to determine their own destiny to some extent. And in the south, a new king unified some of the rival factions and brought a lot of new wealth in through increased trade. So it was sort of a time of peace and prosperity. The economy was doing great. The Jerusalem Stock Exchange was booming, and the wealthy were getting a lot wealthier. But there was also a debt crisis. Does that sound familiar? Peasants throughout Palestine were losing their ancestral farms to foreclosure. And it wasn't, once they lost the title, obviously it wasn't the wealthy investors that were coming in and working the land after that. The peasants stayed there and worked the land for the new landlord for free, basically. They had to turn over all the proceeds to the landlord. It's a situation that was also happening at the time of Jesus, and some of the ferment in Hebrew society at the time of Jesus came from that same situation. But incredibly, back in the 8th century, what happened in response to all this injustice was that a prophetic tradition arose, the likes of which had never been seen among the Hebrew people. The 8th century prophets, Isaiah and Amos and Hosea and Micah, were actually sort of like activists. I guess they weren't political activists because politics was kind of closed at the time. And by the way, maybe the more political our activism gets, the less effective it is as well, right? But maybe they were spiritual activists or to use a really, really well-worn term, community organizers. Yes, there are a lot of references. If you read through these prophecies and even read through the reading that we had today, there's a lot of references to anachronistic things like idol worship that maybe we don't identify with today. But if you just kind of substitute these references to idol worship with the idea that cultural values are being violated, you can see that the overriding issue was social justice. And so in our reading from today, Amos says that the women of Israel can't get a pass on this one, even though technically it's their husbands that are actively doing the oppression because of the way society is structured. Amos calls them cows of Bashan, which is reference to an area that we now call the Golan Heights. You ever heard of that area? It's an area that's higher in elevation, has a little more rainfall, and so there's lots of grass up there, and the cows get nice and fat. And the women, these women had, you know, what it's saying is the women had come to expect a certain lifestyle, even at the expense of the basic dignity and well-being of other human beings. Now, I don't think we would compare even women we don't like to a cow today, those of us who are more refined anyway, right? And I think we probably don't like the stereotype presented here from a feminist perspective. But the overarching point is relevant today. The wealthy are making themselves wealthier on the backs of regular people. And I think the same thing is happening today, and I think we need to speak the truth to kleptocracy. Whether the institution that's the klepto is stealing, or the klepto is a government or a corporation or a church or whatever. Think about corporations. Some of them are salivating at the deregulation that they're expecting these days. The profit opportunities from the end of net neutrality, the huge profit potential from shifting spending from helping the poor to building more bombs. That's kleptocracy in my book. And then there's the big-time kleptocrats, right? Financial analysts who know about this stuff estimate that Vladimir Putin is the richest person in the world, with a net worth of $70 to $80 billion. Richer than Warren Buffett or Bill Gates or anyone else. He was presiding over Russia when the entire economy was being transitioned from state-owned to privately owned. So every time a state enterprise was sold off, somehow Putin wound up with a big share of the ownership. Wonder how that happened. The classic definition of kleptocrat, right? And now he has resorted to increasingly authoritarian and vicious tactics to stay in power. And that's who our government has decided to cozy up with, potentially even sacrificing other diplomatic relationships built over decades. Our president has declined to divest his assets and nakedly promotes his properties for government business and diplomatic visits. And when we finally got a tiny fragment of one of his tax returns, albeit a 12-year-old tax return, it kind of felt like an archaeologist who had just found a fragment of a biblical text or something, right? But it made it clear that the tax proposals that are before us today would have saved him tens of millions of dollars that particular year. While his spending proposal, as I said, includes massive cuts to programs for the poor, bigger than we've ever seen, and we've seen a lot of cuts to programs for the poor, and huge increases in military spending, and we're not talking about giving raises to our soldiers, right? We're talking about building more weapons. Kleptocracy? We report, you decide. If you're my Facebook friend, you know that I could go on and on and on with this. But in these trying times, I just want to make an observation. The 8th century prophets started a period of several centuries where there was a somewhat healthy, creative, relatively equal tension between two types of leadership, priestly and prophetic. Priestly leadership is nurturing and respectful of tradition and focused on maintaining institutions, and yes, focused on maintaining the status quo and keeping the people currently in power in power. And prophetic leadership shakes things up and tells the truth where the truth needs to be told. Kings tend to ally themselves with priests and work against prophets as a rule, but prophets call nations back to their core values. The fact that these prophetic texts survived at all indicates that their message must have gotten through at least to some segments of society. And I think the resistance that has built up in so many forms over the last few months has the potential to do the same. I wish I could report that as a result of the message of the 8th century prophets, a utopia developed where social justice was paramount. But that wasn't the case. But they did have an impact, and we can too. In our post-truth political world, people of faith need to be truth tellers. And in this world where the ultra-wealthy suck up all the economic gains that the rest of us produced, we need to be speaking that truth to power. And we may have to be loud and a little obnoxious. The media's really not covering us to the level that they covered the Tea Party, despite the fact that our numbers have always been greater than the Tea Party ever had. I don't know how to end this except to challenge you to speak out about anything that you're passionate about that is under threat in today's climate. Speak truth to kleptocracy, no matter who the klepto is, right? There's plenty of villains to go around. Bring your message back to the basic values we share as humans. Decency, compassion, truthfulness. I think as people of faith, we share these values with a large spectrum of human beings. But we have a special ability to connect those values to spirit. And with all of the challenges we face, I think we need every person of faith that we can get. Go forth and shake things up.